As Massachusetts officially begins to reopen this week and more businesses and services become available to people, one of the biggest questions on the minds of many is, how am I going to get where I need to go? A big part of that question involves public transit and what that's even going to look like in the age of the coronavirus. We are going to dive into that question today, and we start with a conversation we had earlier this afternoon with Steve Poftak, general manager of the MBTA. He told us that as the state begins to reopen, safety will be a top priority for the T.
First and foremost on our mind is safety, safety for our workforce and safety for our passengers. So we've been thinking about that a great deal. We're also thinking about how the MBTA's service evolves over time. As we go through these different phases and phases that don't necessarily have a concrete time frame associated with them.
So let's stay on that safety question for a minute. Steve, two specific safety measures I want to ask you about, both masks and distancing. Let's start with masks. You've talked about the challenge in enforcing the mask requirement. Governor Baker did specifically name public transit vehicles in his order requiring masks in public. Would a stricter enforcement policy on masks help potential riders feel more confident in their choice of whether or not to take the T, and why not have a more strict enforcement policy?
Well, a couple things. First, I think the language here is really important. The executive order from the governor talks about face coverings, right, which includes masks, but also includes a variety of other things, scarves, bandanas, cloths. I don't know if you've seen the cloths with the elastic bands that you can fit over your ears. So most people should have this available to them. We think it's really important that they do it for their own health, for the health of those around them, both riders and our workforce. In the order, it says folks with certain medical conditions, both behavioral health and sort of respiratory-related medical conditions, don't have to wear the masks, and no one is allowed to ask them to verify that they actually have this medical condition. So we're in a position where we really can't enforce it in a kind of police action kind of way. However, we're really asking everyone to wear a mask who can't on the MBTA.
Have you thought, at least on trains where there are separate cars, have you thought of trying a specific train car that is a no-mask car, and then all the other cars are mask cars?
We have not. You know, again, I think the practicality of enforcing some of these things, I think, would be very difficult. On the Green Line, when you've got a typical two-car train, sort of the notion of having one car dedicated to folks who are, you know, in some cases, perhaps not complying with the face covering doesn't feel like an approach we would want to take.
What do you think riders are going to have to believe in order to come back to trains and buses en masse?
Well, I mean, I think first, I think it's important to note that the reopening advisory commission and the plan the governor's put forward doesn't envision folks coming back en masse anytime soon, right? And I mean, if you think about here in Boston, a bunch of the things that drive demand for transit, like, you know, big events like Red Sox game, schools being open, folks traveling to the airport, that's surely not going to be present, at least over the summer. You know, I do think people want to know that we are appropriately cleaning the buses and taking care of our workforce and that people are wearing masks. So we're going to do a public information campaign around that. I think that's going to be an important message to get out to people. There's also been a lot of discussion with the business community around demand management. Again, you know, the old commute had a big peak at 8:30 and a big peak at 5:30. We are hopeful that we can, to the extent that folks continue to work from home, that some of that demand doesn't resurface, and also that we can spread out the peak, which allows us to take advantage of some of the additional capacity we might be able to provide kind of on the shoulder of each rush hour, as opposed to having it really concentrated at the rush hour. Right now, we have far fewer customers, but even that group of customers is more dispersed. The peak is less dramatic, and it's actually earlier. Our peak now is around 6:30 and 3:30, which I think tracks pretty closely with the shift changes at medical facilities.
Let's stay on demand management then, and this will come back to the social distancing question I have for you as well. I'm guessing you're aware about a picture that was posted on Twitter on Monday, and it showed, reportedly, the Silver Line number 4 bus during the morning commute. The picture makes it appear that the bus is absolutely packed. Now, I know the T has said you are investigating. Any updates on that and any reactions to that photo?
I don't have an update on that specific incident. We're still looking into it. We do have bus routes where we do have some crowding. I would say in general, we don't, but there are a couple specific places. I think one of the things we've seen here is that although buses are down to about 23 or 24% of typical ridership, it's not across the board. There's certain bus routes that have a higher percentage of customers than that. I think what we're looking at right now is how do we think about measuring crowding, and then how do we communicate it to our customers, and then what sort of response can we do in terms of addressing the supply of transit to deal with some of these issues.
As you're addressing supply, would setting a hard limit on the number of riders per bus or per train car also be on the table? I mean, they do that, for example, in grocery stores. Some retail shops will be doing that.
Yes, and I think in those environments, my grocery store does that. They line you up 6 feet apart, and then it's one in and one out. I think to do that in a static setting is different than it would be on a transit system. You know, the example I've used a couple times is if you think of a Blue Line train, the idea of metering people on and off a Blue Line train and trying to run service at a reasonable frequency is incompatible, right? The notion that the motor person who's got a pretty demanding job to begin with is also expected to keep track of 6 train cars and whether it's over or under some notional number, I don't think is going to be feasible. We do want to message to folks that they should socially distance where possible. Part of the thinking behind the face coverings executive order is that in places where social distancing isn't possible, that people will be wearing face coverings. So I think we're going to take a variety of approaches, but this kind of hard cap enforcement is not an approach that we are comfortable with right now.
I did wonder, I was surprised on Monday when the full plans came out, that capacity you're still at reduced levels in phase one. If you can't limit ridership per car, wouldn't it make sense, train car or bus, wouldn't it make sense to expand capacity in this first phase? Because clearly more people are going to be moving around as we begin to reopen.
Yes, and I think one of the big variables there for us is employee availability. You know, the MBTA is a large workforce, 6,400 employees. I should say 88% of those employees cannot work from home, right? They cannot drive a bus from your spare bedroom. You cannot fix rail from your den. They're out there working. However, we've had a significant number of folks go on leave related to COVID-19. Over the course of this, probably the last 2 months, we've had 1,000 plus cumulative leaves. Right now, we have 373 people out on leave related in some way to COVID-19. Either it's confirmed, or they're awaiting test results, or they've been exposed and are self-quarantining, or they are caring for someone in that state. So part of us getting back to full capacity is having workforce availability. And I've talked with leaders at other similar transit agencies across the country, and it's a pretty consistent story that we just have a lot of people who have been affected by this.
What are you hearing from workers now as we begin to slowly ramp back up? Public transit workers, are they feeling safe? Are you hearing concerns from them? Are they on board with this approach? What are you hearing?
I mean, I think there's a lot of, I think there is some anxiety. I think we have come a long way in terms of providing not only kind of tangible things like PPE for them to use, but also, we put some policies in place. We do rear door boarding on the buses. We have seats, the seats closest to the, for instance, the trolley operators on the Green Line are now blocked off. So we've done a lot in that regard. We've also essentially made anyone at the MBTA who wants to be tested for COVID-19 has a test available to them. So we've tested over 1,000 employees at this point, again, on a base of about 6,400. So I think we've done a lot to build confidence in the workforce. That said, I'm not driving the bus. on a daily basis. They are. And I do think everyone is very cautious at this stage.
Steve, I want to shift gears for a minute, talk a little bit about finances. I know you've said that fare revenue is at about 10% of what it was, and you're projecting that it won't reach 60% really until June of 2021. I mean, that's going to leave a huge hole in a budget. How much money are we talking about in lost revenues?
Well, what we are doing right now is we got approximately $830 million in the last round of federal stimulus legislation. And we are using that money to plug the gap, not only in this fiscal year, FY20, but in next fiscal year as well. We had just passed a draft budget in early March that then when this all hit, you know, we essentially had to rip it up and start over. So some of the initiatives that we had in place in the previous budget have either been scaled back or delayed. But right now, I am hopeful tomorrow, actually, at the Fiscal Management Control Board meeting that we will pass a final budget that utilizes this funding. It does utilize all of the funding we got in the stimulus bill. So in FY22, we're going to have to see where we are in terms of revenues and expenses and start from there. But I mean, I will say this has been an incredibly challenging period because I don't think anyone can predict with any certainty how our economy is going to reopen, what the course of this virus is going to be, and how our ridership will react.
So we've had numerous conversations on this show over the last year about infrastructure, concerns among the public about safety capacity, et cetera, plans you had for capital improvements, infrastructure improvements. What happens to all of that now? I can't imagine that you can just continue as planned with these kinds of financial shortfalls, even if you do have federal money to help close the gap in the near term?
Well, our sources of capital funding are relatively stable, so we're continuing to do a lot of that work. There was some of the work that was not safety critical was put on hold for a period of time, and that was in order to preserve our engineering and maintenance capacity so that they could work to make sure that the system continued to operate and operate safely. Now we've switched modes a little bit now because of just sort of the stage we're in, where we are looking at doing more ambitious closures, partly to take advantage of the lower ridership. For instance, right now, the Blue Line is closed from Airport to Bowdoin, and it is, and there is a ton of work going on. We have, I think, literally six companies and at least five internal departments at the MBTA down on the Blue Line as we speak, working on it because it has been fully closed, and we're busing customers, and we're able to do that because the ridership volumes are relatively low, the buses are available, and the traffic isn't that bad, so we can actually get people on a bus where they need to go as a replacement for the Blue Line.
We are in the middle of a public health tragedy, so much it's kind of hard to get our minds around it. We do know, Steve, about that old saying that old philosophy that tragedy and opportunity go together. You just talked about, for example, with lower ridership, being able to do some things differently in terms of improvements or repairs. People are beginning to think about what the new normal ought to be and whether or not that should be a return to the way things were or something really different. In your mind, what would be your vision for what should be really different in public transit in our new normal?
Well, I mean, I think we want to be, thoughtful and analytical about how we think about what service is most needed. And I think that's probably one where our ridership will guide us. I think we've gotten, one of the interesting sort of tertiary impacts of having this low ridership under these conditions is we've gotten a really strong idea of the folks who need the bus, who use the bus, almost regardless, who have to take the bus and take the subway regardless of conditions. And I think that will inform our planning as we go forward. I think we'll also look very carefully at how ridership comes back. And we may, that may cause us to think differently about our priorities. So I think this is one where I will let our riders and passengers guide us as we think about the future.
And that's MBTA General Manager Steve Poftak. Steve, thanks for coming back and joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
We are talking about public transportation as the Massachusetts economy begins to reopen. Before the break, we heard from MBTA General Manager Steve Poftak about the T's approach to Massachusetts reopening. We're going to continue that conversation, and we want you to be a part of it. What would it take for you to feel comfortable riding public transit again? Do you think the T is doing enough to ensure rider safety? And are you worried about returning to our all too familiar and jam-packed communities as businesses begin to reopen? What should be different? What can we do differently going forward? Call us. Join the conversation, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. We have two guests here with me to have this conversation. The first is former State Transportation Secretary Jim Eloisi. He's also a member of the Transit Matters Board and the principal of TriMount Consulting. Jim, welcome back to Radio Boston.
It's good to be back, Tatiana.
Also joining us is Chris Dempsey, director of the nonprofit Transportation for Massachusetts. He also served as Assistant Secretary of Transportation in the Patrick administration. Chris, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks. It's great to be on.
All right. So I want to start with both of you. I know you were listening to that interview with T General Manager Steve Poftak. Let's get reactions. And Jim, why don't you go first?
Well, the first thing I want to say is just to be really clear, because sometimes when people hear you sound critical, they don't understand one thing. And the one thing I know is true for me and Chris is that we have a lot of respect for anybody in public service under any normal time. We have a great deal of respect for people under these conditions, whether it's the general manager or a bus driver or anybody in between working for the T, that respect is there. And I want to say that up front, because our role as advocates doesn't mean we stop our work in a time of crisis. And so my reaction, frankly, is one of disappointment, because I'm of the view that we're being too tentative and too timid, and we're not learning enough from best practices elsewhere and applying them here. So, for example, two items that you had with the general manager about not limiting riders per bus or per train car and not enforcing mask or face covering wearing. So we won't limit riders. We won't deal with masks. And so my question is, well, what will we do? I think that we know that, for example, the Chicago system has limited people on a bus to 15 per bus, and Rhode Island's doing the same and other places are. So if they can do that, I think we can do that. I don't think anybody.
Now, Jim, wait. I want to stop you there for a second, though, Jim.
Sure.
In all fairness, Steve Poftak said because of the way the governor's order on masks was written, he didn't think he had the ability to do that enforcement. So I didn't hear necessarily we won't deal with that as much as we can't. Did you have a different interpretation there?
Because I'll be the first to say I'm not asking for the T to enforce it. They shouldn't be enforcing it. That gets us into a different realm. Here's what they should be doing. They should be facilitating it, okay? And how do you facilitate it? Well, Steve talked about messaging, and that's important, and they should do it. But, you know, I think the T needs to be figuring out how to work with a philanthropic group or a foundation, someone who can help provide it with masks, purchase masks, and have folks giving out masks to folks who don't have them. So there are ways to facilitate the governor's order without enforcement. And if we understand that distinction, we can understand that the T is not even, other than messaging, they're not even facilitating. And I think it's incumbent upon the T to think about stepping up its approach, both to limiting riders, which requires more frequency of buses in particular, and facilitating the use of face protection. Those are the kinds of things that we're not seeing. And I think really need to be put in place if people are going to feel safe and, in fact, be safe. One of the things we know pretty clearly.
I'm going to pause you there again. I'm sorry. Sure. It's just we haven't gotten Chris's voice in yet.
Sure.
I want to get Chris Dempsey in here. Chris, why don't you react to what you heard from Jim and anything else you heard from Steve Poftak?
Sure. Well, I'll start with agreeing with Jim that Steve Poftak is doing the best job that he can in many ways, and I applaud his service. And the last few months have also been a reminder that transit operators, bus drivers and subway operators are frontline workers. They are essential workers, and we should all be grateful to them for the job that they're doing. Tashiana, I think one of the best questions you asked in that interview, and it was a really informative interview, was about why not have full service? Why are we still running a reduced Saturday schedule as we're seeing ridership start to pick back up. And I'm glad you mentioned that photo that came out on Monday of this week of people packed onto the Silver Line 3, I think it was, in Chelsea and East Boston heading downtown. I don't see why we're running lower service. Now, Steve brought up that there are some T employees who are not able to come to work. Either they're sick themselves or they're caring for people. And that is a very real dynamic. But that's about 5, maybe 6% of the T's workforce. And so maybe you need to reduce it by 5 or even 10%. But when you're running a weekend schedule, you're reducing it by 20, 30%, even more in some cases. And so that's an area where the T needs to do more. I will compliment the T on things like its policy of requiring masks on riders, of allowing rear door boarding on buses, of creating more screens and more physical distance between the drivers and passengers. All of those are good things, but there's definitely more it could be doing.
All right. So Chris and Jim, hang on. We've got calls pouring in and we've got one caller, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation, which we want you to do. Call in with your thoughts. It's a really important subject. We have one caller who I think can talk, has a question about this bus capacity issue. We've got Ellen on the line from Brookline. Ellen, go ahead.
Hi. Yeah. I'm concerned with a 66 bus. It runs right exactly in the middle of my neighborhood, right at the top of my, about at the top of my street. That bus alone goes through six major congestion-ridden areas. You know, I'm not going to say before it gets to where I live, but, you know, I mean, quite, I'm talking Coolidge Corner, by the way. You know, but even still, from if I count from the all from if I count from Nubian all the way through the South End, Brookline Village, Coolidge Corner, crossing where, you know, Com Ave meets Alston, the whole bit, all the way down to Harvard Square where it ends. And a bus.
So
like
you're saying
that,
lots of people, Ellen. It sounds like you're concerned about transmission on a bus that crowded.
Yeah, and it's perpetually swamped, especially on the weekdays. And if I have to, I know that the only way I can get to Watertown, I do not have a car. I have to take the 66 until I can pick up the 70 and then go from there to Watertown just to go to the registry there.
All right, Ellen, thanks for that. I'm going to turn to Jim first. Sure. I hear several themes in Ellen's call, Jim. Let me let you pick them up, and then I'll add in questions if necessary.
Sure.
Go ahead.
I mean, I think Ellen's call, to me, reaffirms what Chris and I have just talked about, and that is the duality of limiting riders per bus and providing more frequency, more frequent service. Those things go hand in hand. So if you think about, by the way, the business group, A Better City, last week issued a report, very thoughtful, comprehensive report that talks specifically to how you can do this limiting of people per bus, which, as I pointed out earlier, other agencies are doing, like Chicago and Rhode Island. If you limit people per bus, you can distance them on the bus. Then the question comes, are you leaving people behind? And the answer is not if you run more frequent service. So what the T really needs to do is be agile. Maybe the T needs to move some service away from low demand lines right now to higher demand lines, run that service more frequently. Running more service is the answer to a lot of issues regarding not just distancing, but also restoring confidence in the system. Part two of the story is cooperating with the city. The mayor of Somerville has announced closing a variety of streets. It's a very important initiative. The mayor of Boston is talking about doing the same. The cities in the inner core on key bus routes need to work with the T immediately, in my view, to provide buses with dedicated lanes. Even though there's not a lot of traffic today, there may be tomorrow, there may be next week. And we need to have those dedicated lanes in place so that bus speeds and frequencies are not impacted negatively.
So, Chris Dempsey, I'm going to turn to you here. I just want to note, we had somebody look it up. We think the picture that was tweeted out on Monday was from Silver Line number 4 bus, just so you know. Let me let you build on what Jim had to say just there, and then I have a follow-up question.
Sure. Well, first of all, I'm glad that Ellen brought up the 66. It also goes right in front of my house, actually, in Brookline, and I'm a regular rider of that bus. I will say that I know Jim has a lot of conviction on the idea that we should be limiting the number of passengers on a vehicle. I'm not quite there yet. I'm really concerned that there will be people who will be left behind, and that we're putting the operators of the buses who already have a difficult job in the position of trying to enforce the number of people on buses. I don't think that's a very good idea. If you look at any image of people riding a bus today, they are absolutely essential workers. They are getting to grocery stores, they are getting to healthcare facilities. And to say to them they can't get on a bus and they have to wait up to maybe half an hour or more for the next bus to come does not seem fair and equitable to me. So that's a place where Jim and I disagree.
Well,
I do think it's a really important issue to run more service, and that's.
Chris, I don't want them to wait a half hour for the next bus. My point is, you have to run more frequent service on that route, whether it's the 28 bus or the 111 or the 5. The wait for the next bus should be 3 minutes. It shouldn't be a half hour. If you give people that additional frequency of service in this moment, then no one's being left behind. And I think it is a social equity issue and a public health issue. We need to make sure that those essential workers have the best bus ride possible under these circumstances. And so I'm not asking for people to have long waits. I'm asking them to have really short waits because the T's responding with frequent service.
I'm glad that you both brought up the equity issue as well. When I was on faculty at Boston College, we did some research there on intersectionality between race, socioeconomic status, and access to transportation. And one of the things that became clear was that your race, your racial identity, and your socioeconomic status correlated with whether you had access to buses or trains. And so much of what we've been talking about with essential workers and their access to transportation has been laced with socioeconomic status, neighborhood you live in, racial identity. And it does feel like this is a moment when that needs to come to the forefront, and we need to be having a larger equity conversation while dealing with the immediate need right in front of us.
Yeah, I know. I agree. And the equity issues are far and wide. There's an immediate equity issue about responding to the needs of the people I just mentioned, those on the bus routes like the 22, the 28, the 111, the Silver Line 5, there are a bunch of others that are clear high demand bus routes. I say take some capacity away from low demand routes and step up the frequency immediately on those routes and work with the city to create dedicated bus lanes as a first step. There's a longer term play here. Harvard came out with a study about 3 weeks ago that tied long-term exposure to particulate matter in the air to a 15% higher COVID mortality rate. Now, particulate matter is what happens with auto emissions. It's also what happens with diesel truck and diesel locomotive emissions, right? The T needs to commit to moving toward a clean fuels service by moving toward electric rail and electric bus in the future. But more to the immediate point, the T needs to step up its service game so that there is an alternative to people driving in and out and polluting the air more. The people who are being hit hardest in Chelsea, for example, particulate matter in the air in Chelsea must be much higher than it is in places in suburbs because of the location and what we're doing in terms of traffic congestion. So that's a longer term equity issue. And many of these issues can be addressed if we take the opportunity not to go back to the pre-COVID normal, but to go forward to a better place that has more robust, safer public transportation, and frankly, encourages other sustainable modes like cycling safely and walking.
Let's grab a couple more calls here. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got a lot of callers on the line. Dave is on from Cape Cod. Dave, what's on your mind?
So your question was, what will it take for me to feel safe on the T? And the answer is, and it's like this for a lot of things it's going forward in life, we'll just see how it works out. You know, a month from now, after we've been open a little while and the country's been open a little while, we'll see how it's going. If it's not a catastrophe, we'll take the next little step. And, you know, those tweaks that these guys are mentioning about increasing service and making masks like a thing that you pass out as you get on, those are great ideas. But I think until we just get used to we're just going to get used to doing things a certain way. And the more we do that, the better it'll be, and we'll feel much safer because we'll be used to doing it that way.
I appreciate that call, Dave, and I'm going to add another voice with yours. We've got Laura on the line from Medford. Laura, go ahead.
Thanks. Yep. Chiming in there on that same point, one, a vaccine would be the biggest reason I'd get back on the tee. But also, listen, we have to talk about the fact that the tee had nearly monthly derailments before COVID. And even during COVID, with reduced service and reduced ridership, the delay times have been astronomical. So because of, you know, the tracks and service, et cetera, nothing to do with ridership. So I think that the two things that have to happen is that people have to feel safer, and two, the tee actually has to be more reliable. No one wants to be stuck on a red line train at rush hour in a packed compartment, all wearing masks, no matter what. And that is
great
absolutely
call,
a nightmare,
Laura,
for some.
I really appreciate that, and I'm going to give Chris Dampsey a chance to respond to both those calls.
Sure. I think Dave and Laura are making both great points there. What Dave is saying is, look, we are in sort of a new world and a new normal, and we're going to have to each individually feel some of this out and see what we're comfortable with. At the same time, we need to make sure that our public leaders are trying to set up the right circumstances for all of us so that we can feel more comfortable. We are not going to work as a region if we give up on public transit and decide to all just start driving. We're only going to have more congestion, more air pollution, and more frustration. And I think Laura's point is also very well taken here. The MBTA was a system that just in December was cited as a system and a culture that was not emphasizing safety and was not living up to national standards for safe operations. That's a pre-existing condition, so to speak, that's now made worse in some ways by the coronavirus crisis. And so we're going to need more investment. We're going to need more attention to public transit and more leadership from everyone from the governor on down in state office and in local office to say, this is a priority for our region. We're only going to thrive and come out of this crisis recovering strongly if we make sure that transit works well.
So Chris and Jim, I think one of the things that's on my mind, you heard in the interview with Steve Poftak, where we talked about the fact that he's not expecting revenues and ridership to be back to even 60% of its previous level until 2021. Now, I get it that some of that is because people will be staying at home and working from home, but I got to believe that some of that is that more people will be in cars. And I know you both do not want us to return to the level of cars that we were before, but that feels like a pretty sticky wicket. I mean, how do we not go back to everybody on the roads when we're hearing Laura call and say, you know, when I'll get back on the tee? When there's a vaccine. I want to hear more about the vision for how we address that challenge.
Well, I think there are a couple of things that we want to do. The first thing we got to do is get the tee up and running, improving itself again, which is why Chris and I think they should be running more regular frequent service, right? So number one, the tee needs to prove itself, and I think it will. By the way, I don't think going to using the tee is going to be any less safe than going to the grocery store, because some of the factors that are at play here are how much time you're exposed as opposed to anything else. And so the tee needs to prove itself, and it needs to run more frequent service and just start running more. We also need to understand that in this new normal, if people are shifting away from public transportation toward other sustainable modes, like cycling safely and walking safely, that's not a bad thing. And so within the inner core communities, Boston, Cambridge, Somerville, Arlington, we need to be building more protected cycling lanes. We need to be building dedicated bus lanes. And we need to be expanding our streetscape to more safe, complete streets. This will be good for small business because of the opportunity to have density without crowding. So some of that is not within the purview of the tee, but if our cities are going to come back, they need to support bringing the tee back, and in part encouraging those who may shift to walking and cycling by doing those kinds of initiatives. And then I think we need to rethink our, and Steve said this, Steve Poftak said, we need to be thoughtful about service. I agree. That's correct. Steve's right on that. They're doing this in San Francisco. It may be that the new normal for the tee thinks a little bit differently about routes, thinks a little bit differently about how it provides service, particularly on the bus side of the house. We should not, again, be returning to the status quo before COVID. It needs to be rethought and realigned. And it's a combination of interventions at the municipal level and with the MBTA together to bring us to that point.
Chris Dempsey, do you agree with that?
I do. Tishiana, I think we're not going to go back to the worst congestion in the country overnight. It is going to happen over time as people slowly get back into the workforce. And let's remember, we're probably facing at least a recession, if not a depression. And so our employment levels will be lower, and that will keep some folks off the road. That's not a good thing, but it will be one small benefit to the transportation system. I want to point out kind of two things that people have really noticed in the last few months. The first is the dramatic drop in air pollution. You can look at the air quality reader in Kenmore Square, where nitrous oxide is down by 50% and even more than that, down more than that at rush hour periods. That's a tailpipe emission that causes asthma and all sorts of cardiovascular and respiratory diseases. And the other thing that we're seeing is that because streets are open, people are noticing that, you know what, their neighborhoods are a little bit nicer, that it's nice to have a little bit less noise and have a little bit more space for maybe kids to play in the street or be safe cycling on a neighborhood street. Those are two things that we can keep with us in the future if we adopt the right policies. Some of the things that Jim just laid out, those are not things that can only exist during a public health crisis. They can be with us all the time if we take the right approach.
All right, let's get one more of our caller voices in here before the end of this segment. We've got Mary on the line from Cambridge. Mary, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm calling because I have lived for years on and off in Paris and London, and for 1 year in Berlin, and used the systems in other European cities. It's part of my work. And the subways, metros, whatever, they come every 2 or 3 minutes. The buses are almost that good, and they have dedicated bus lanes. And as a result, they go everywhere, and there is not an inequality problem. You don't go to a different part of town and wait half an hour. And so I just, you know, it works. I've experienced it in several very different countries, in fact, but countries with our kind of standard of living. And I want to say, I realize it's a giant ask, but our legislature has been underfunding the T for decades. And it's not surprising that people are afraid of big reform.
Okay, Mary, I'm going to take it back from you for there on that issue, because it gives me a chance to talk to our panelists about the legislature in particular. We have about 3 minutes left in this segment. I'd love to hear one thing from each of you about the role of the legislature in this. Chris Dempsey, why don't you go first?
Yeah, so you may remember, Tishiana, that it was actually the week before this crisis really hit that the House passed some ambitious legislation to raise more money for transportation and to invest more money in transportation. And then everything sort of fell apart in the legislature after that, and their entire focus to COVID-19. We're hopeful that the Senate will take some action. It may not be a comprehensive bill, but there's the transportation bill and then the state budget, both of which can be vehicles for good transportation policy that can help at least incrementally move us ahead, maybe with some more funding, but also with ideas like more bus lanes or piloting congestion pricing and studying that concept. That's something they do in London, where your caller just pointed out their system works a lot better. All of those are possible later this year with this legislative session, and we're going to push hard to make that happen.
Okay, and before I go to Jim for the last word on that, Chris, I just do want to say NPR does have some analysis that has found that pollution declines aren't quite as large or as large as early indicators might have suggested. Just the thought that it's going to take even more than traffic changes in order to reduce that overall pollution and improve air quality. That's something that listeners can find more about at the WBUR website. Jim, let me give you a chance to weigh in on the legislature question.
Sure. The legislature hopefully will act. I think they will do so. I think there are a couple of critical things. They need to extend this current fiscal and management control board for another year. We need stability at the T. This board knows what it's doing. This board a new board would only be learning on the job. This is no time for changing the board. The board expires in a month. So the legislature needs to act urgently to extend this board for 12 months. I think they should be raising the gas tax. Gas prices are under $2 a gallon. Very few people are driving. I think they should also be enacting into law Chairman Boncori's bill, which he filed on behalf of Mayor Walsh, which would give the mayor the power to impose a fee on commercial parking spaces in Boston. Those are the kinds of things that will bring some urgently needed net new revenue into the system. If I could say quickly with Mary, the last caller, she's absolutely right. The old idea of rush hour and having peak hours is just that. It's an old idea. We need to think differently. We need frequent all-day service on the T, because the idea of the old peak rush hours, AM and PM, I think will be a thing of the past and a welcome thing of the past in a new normal.
Well, this has been a great conversation. I want to thank the callers. I want to thank Steve Poftak. And I want to thank both of you, Jim Aloisi, former State Secretary of Transportation, member of the Transit Matters Board, and principal of Trimount Consulting. Jim, thanks for being here.
Always a pleasure.
And Chris Dempsey, director of the nonprofit Transportation for Massachusetts. Chris also served as Assistant Secretary of Transportation in the Patrick administration. Chris, thanks for giving us the time today.
Thanks so much, Tishiana.
And this is a conversation we will keep having on Radio Boston. We've talked a lot about transit in the past. We will talk a lot more in the future as we all find our way through the new normal. Appreciate you being a part of it today, listeners who called in. Boston College says they will bring students back on campus this fall. The school is one of just a few institutions so far who say they plan to hold in-person classes. They join Northeastern University, who has also enacted a phased return and intends to reopen this fall. Joining me with the news is WBUR reporter Fred Tice. Hey there, Fred.
Hi, Tiziana. Good to talk to you.
You too, Fred. So big news out of Boston College today, where I was on faculty before I came here to WBUR. Why are they so sure they're reopening with students?
So Father William Leahy, the president of Boston College, wrote to the community yesterday explaining that they're making this decision because they happen to have about 400 students who stayed on campus when all the other students were sent home. Those are largely students who felt that they just could not go home, and the college decided to let them stay. And they learned that they could pretty much configure the college in a safe way just from looking at how they handled these 400 students. Father Leahy said that the health department of the college has figured out how to isolate students and how to test.
So, Fred, how's the school community reacting to the news? What are you hearing among BC folks?
I'm seeing a reaction online. When I heard this yesterday, I went online to try to in different places to see how people were responding and from the Boston College community. And the students, there's a lot of enthusiasm. There's some skepticism. You know, some students didn't seem to feel like it was necessarily safe to come back, and they're wondering whether the college is doing this because it really needs the money. One student that I read on one of the social media websites was saying that he was wondering why there's not a detailed plan yet, because Notre Dame made the same announcement a few days ago, but had much more detail as to how it was going to reopen.
So, this is a question, Fred. What about students, professors, faculty, staff who don't feel safe coming back? What has Boston College said about what will happen, to or for them?
So the only thing in President Leahy's letter is that they want to be mindful of the safety and health of everyone in the community, but they have not specifically addressed what they will do about students or professors who do not feel safe coming back. And by the way, surveys generally show that universities have done generally show students feel really good. They want to come back, and faculty are a little bit more cautious.
Okay, so the fall semester doesn't start until August or later. What is the pressure for universities to be deciding now instead of waiting to see how the next month or so goes? I mean, even in the Commonwealth, we don't go to phase two till we've seen how phase one goes.
One of the things that colleges are realizing is the more they can persuade students that there will be a physical reopening on campus, the better, more likely it is that those students are actually going to enroll. So far, colleges are saying that the deposits have exceeded their expectations. They're not really saying what their expectations were. But students can make their deposit and still back out before they have to show up in the fall. And colleges are afraid that students may take either a gap year or a year off. There have been surveys that show that As much as about 15% of students are considering taking a year off. However, I want to give you some pushback on that. A few weeks ago, maybe a couple of weeks ago, spoke to the Dean of Admissions at Wellesley College, and she was telling me that they're actually seeing the number of students asking for a gap year going down, because generally when students ask for a gap year when they're graduating from high school, they're expecting to go to some organized program in Europe or some other country, or some other part of the world. And those programs, of course, are not going now. And so I think a lot of students are realizing that there may not be much else to do but to go to college.
Yeah. So, Fred, we've got about 2 minutes left. I want to shift gears here, because you went to a meeting that five local universities had with the Boston Chamber of Commerce today. BNU, Northeastern, Bunker Hill, Emerson, UMass. What was your big takeaway from today?
I think the big takeaway is, what does it take? You know, they're all really worried about what it takes to come back. For a BU president, Bob Brown, it's testing. He was asked, you know, what keeps him up at night? In one word, he said testing. And he said that testing is going to be an essential part of reopening.
We'll have an announcement later this week. We are in the process of standing up our own testing facility at the university. Also important are going to be symptom tracking, contact tracing, which we're going to have to do, not relying on others. And then finally, the ability to isolate suspected or real COVID patients.
Northeastern's president, Joseph Fayoun. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go.
Oh, yes, I was saying Northeastern's president, Joseph Fayoun, is also saying that the university is developing its own testing and contact tracing. But he's also saying that he's noticing that much of the university world is moving online and may just stay there. He cited as an example, Northeastern is a school famous for its co-op programs, where students get 18 months of work experience while enrolled. And he's seeing that most of the co-ops are moving online.
Over 75% of our co-ops now have moved to be online, to be remote. So that's, the employers are doing that and are getting our students to have their co-op experience online.
So Fred, I'm going to take it back from you there. We've only got about 15 seconds left. So just very briefly, what are you watching for next?
Well, just what the universities, you know, what the universities are going to say about how they can keep students safe. I mean, Bob Brown has said he's going to isolate students into small groups. But does that mean you prevent them from mixing with other groups? And how do you make them safe from COVID-19? And what are their parents going to say about that?
Yeah, no kidding. So many open questions. We'll look forward to pursuing more of them with you. That's WBUR reporter Fred Tice. Thanks.
Great to talk to you. Tiziana.